I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. Hey, this is Howard Jacobson, and I am delighted to be joined on the phone today by Wes Youngberg, who is a... what are you, Wes?
Hi, Howard. Good to talk with you today. I'm essentially a lifestyle medicine specialist with a master's degree in nutrition. I did my doctorate of public health in preventive care and lifestyle medicine specifically, and had a wonderful journey over the last 25 years, helping people recognize, their opportunity to not just prevent disease, but actually reverse disease using nutritional medicine principles.
Okay. Great. So I, came across your work through, Brenda Davis, whom I was asking about her work in Guam, I guess in the Marshall Islands. And she said, you know, you're the guy to talk to. So can you tell us, before we get into, the full arc of your story, tell us a little bit about what you did in Guam and kind of how that influenced the way you think about the potential of nutritional and lifestyle medicine.
Right. Well, back in early 1994, I was attending a conference, a health conference in at Loveland University, and one of my senior colleagues, Dr. Gerard McLean, who was at the time the director of the lifestyle medicine program at the Guam Seventh-day Adventist Clinic, he said to me, Wes, why don't you take my spot? You know, we're coming back to the States. And I said, Guam? Where's Guam? I had no idea where that was. And so he gave me some material to look at. And so my wife and I talked about this. And we ended up flying, the 7,000 miles from L.A. to Guam. You know, Guam is another 3,500 miles past Hawaii. So it's essentially just as west as Australia and Japan is. It's way out west. It's so far west, it's actually in the Far East. And we got a chance to spend a couple weeks there and fell in love with the place. It's a beautiful island paradise, wonderful people, but they had a severe crisis with diabetes. Their premature death rate due to diabetes was 5 times higher than here in the U.S. mainland. And so I accepted the position to head up the lifestyle medicine department at this very large medical center, and decided to spend 6 years raising a family there, and we ended up staying 14. It's a wonderful experience, and during that time I had the pleasure of meeting Brenda Davis, where we collaborated on the Marshall Islands Reversing Diabetes Research Project, And, you know, we've been friends ever since and collaborating on other projects now. But I had the opportunity to see the power of lifestyle and nutritional medicine as it impacted the lives of people who had almost died already from the complications of diabetes. These people, even at that point, in the progression of diabetes, were able to reverse diabetes. And so I felt that it was critical to share this information with the world in a format that was easy to understand, easy to read, and if somebody's willing to do what it takes, they can actually reverse diabetes the majority of the time.
So there's a lot of pages out there on what human beings should eat, what's a healthy diet, what's an optimal diet, and there's tons of research, and most people I know are deeply confused because there's so much
right.
out there, and it's all contradictory, and when you read it, it all makes perfect sense, right? Like, there's an internal logic to just about any diet or way, lifestyle or way of eating, but you went out there and you saw an extreme population with an extreme level of a particular disease that's been linked to diet and lifestyle, and you saw huge improvements. So from that perspective, what do you know? Like, what should human beings be eating to be healthy?
Well, I can tell you the type of diet that promotes diabetes the most rapidly is you know, the standard American diet in whatever place that gets exported to. I basically saw a very robust and historically fit people transformed into a very sickly people because they had essentially taken this exported diet from the West into their island culture. And this is a culture where, you know, they rarely ate meat. Yes, they fished, they farmed, but when they started getting the GI rations at World War II, just post World War II, and started, you know, enjoying Spam and processed meats in particular, and then the packaged foods, all the refined foods, and so forth, that's when their metabolism essentially just blew up. They developed these horrible metabolic syndromes, and very quickly they went from an island of very fit, healthy individuals to very sickly individuals that would not only frequently die very prematurely from diabetes, heart disease, and cancer, but also would suffer for decades because of health problems. So, the diet that is best at both preventing and reversing chronic disease is what I call the first class foods diet. And essentially first class foods are nothing more than the foods that have been shown in medical science. And in day-to-day experience to help the body turn off the genes that promote diabetes, that promote heart disease, that promote cancer, and epigenetically, literally turn off the expression of those genes. And so first-class foods are essentially foods that are whole, unprocessed, plant-based. And so to me, that's the best way to go about this. And I don't even make a distinction between, as much between being a vegetarian or non-vegetarian diet. The distinction I make is we want to make sure that what we're eating is actually good for us. And essentially, that's where we're getting foods from plants, but also where it's not been refined or processed. And so that part of the confusion, Howard, is that sometimes a vegetarian diet is being promoted as long as it's vegetarian, we're doing good, when in fact, there's a lot of unhealthy things that you can eat as a vegetarian. I mean, you know, a diet soda or a regular soda is vegetarian. You know, potato chips and french fries are vegetarian. Sugar in any form is vegetarian. But, so in other words, we need to take it, to the level of whole. Right? From a dietary standpoint, in this case, we need to make sure that it is whole, that it is not decompartmentalized, it's not broken down, it's not refined, because when you refine a food that was good, now you've removed a large portion of the healing component of that food. So that's how I would, you know, succinctly define the diet that's best for us is a diet that's whole, that's unprocessed, that's plant-based.
Mm-hmm. So when you started working with the people in Guam, and they, you know, let's start with the ones who were, let's say, easy, who wanted to listen, who were compliant, who were ready to change, you know, for whom there were fewer implementation and compliance issues. What did you see in terms of their health improvements, and how quickly did people start getting better?
Well, that's interesting. You know, when I first arrived on Guam in early 1994, one of the physicians I was talking to, he said, "What? You're gonna try to do what here on Guam?" And so he was kind of, you know, shaking his head and thinking, "Oh, this Howley dude is naive to think that he can actually come to Guam and get people of Guam to change their ways." You know, he basically said, this is entrenched culture. I remember a high school student saying to me, "Look at this. What's so bad about spam? So this is part of our culture. You know, this spam is part of our culture." I go, take a look at the packaging, okay, and read to me where this was manufactured. And he said, "Well, I never thought of looking." So they turned the can around and was looking at it, and it was packaged in Minnesota. I said, "What does something that's packaged in Minnesota have to do with your true culture? This is not part of your true culture. This is something that was imported in a very artificial way, and yeah, it's become part of the new culture, but that has destroyed your traditional culture, and we need to get back to the more traditional culture here." Something again that's sustainable. So the improvements that I've seen, Howard, are wonderful. You know, people who, you know, were interested in their health, you know, all over the world, there's people who are just eager to learn more about what they can do to optimize their health. I think that's an innate human characteristic. We're curious. We're interested in what we can do to improve our health, to optimize the genetic potential that we have. And so, you know, as a lifestyle medicine specialist and as a nutritionist, my role was to help them understand that better. And so we would do broad health testing. We'd do a lot of lab tests and show them what their baseline levels were. And you know, I didn't think I had a problem with my health. Until when I was 24 years old, I discovered that I had high cholesterol. And I'd been a lacto-ovo vegetarian all my life, and it was at that point that I realized that I needed to do better than just avoid eating meats. I wanted to do what was best, and it was the test that brought my awareness to the level that I needed to change. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a big proponent of testing widely so that we can have baseline understanding of where we're at so we can make a change and then see if we've changed for the better. And so, people's cholesterol levels, people's blood sugar levels, blood pressure, weight, all the biomarkers improve dramatically when somebody chooses to change their lifestyle, begin an exercise program, choose whole unprocessed foods, take advantage of resting appropriately and getting outside and open air and sunlight and following all the principles of lifestyle medicine.
Mm. Well, I have so many questions about, the experience of seeing that community shift. I'm guessing the first one is, so they think that spam is part of their traditional culture, which speaks to me of a real sort of breach in cultural memory. When I think about people living on an island undisturbed more or less for thousands of years, for dozens and dozens of generations, my impression is sort of the elders have the wisdom. They're seen as repositories of culture, of how we do things, of appropriate technologies, and sort of in a very short period of time, it felt like there was a break with that entire tradition. And I'm wondering, is that true? Were the elders no longer heard or listened to, and did the people's relationship with the land shift as their diets changed?
There's a lot of issues there. Any of the islands throughout the Western Pacific have been changed forever because of World War II. And they were exposed to the horrific events of that time. And that changed everything. I mean, we struggle when there's a little hiccup in our lives and a little stress and we stop exercising, we stop eating right and then it takes us a month before we get, reorganized and back into our routine. But, what many cultures around the world, went through, it was so horrific. It changed them forever. And then not only were they starting over from, the entire island was essentially bombed to smithereens, in the mid-40s. And so now everybody's starting over, with the post-traumatic shock of all that had happened and transpired. And so now, Big Brother in this case brings in all these GI rations and spam and refined products for them to eat. Of course, they're very grateful that they have something to eat. There's no food otherwise. Everything's been destroyed. People that are in their 70s or older now were young at that time. And so they gratefully accepted all this, and then it just became part of their everyday routine. And so even the elderly are kind of see that as part of their culture now. But we still have there in the islands the statues of the traditional chiefs, Chief Kipua statue, a very, handsome, a rugged, fit individual in a canoe. And so I would always, whenever cultural issues came up with regards to diet, I would always point to the statues of the traditional chiefs and say, do you think Chief Kipua ate spam and was comfortable with this, calling this part of their culture? He says, we need to go back to the true traditional culture. People resonated to that, or they So we had both. We had the lower class in terms of the socioeconomic status, all the way to the politicians and the governor, really paying attention to this and participating in our programs. And I mean, even the governor had monthly. The governor's wife had monthly vegetarian cooking classes at their home that we would put on. So the culture is willing to adapt to what is best if they're given an opportunity, if they're made aware of what they could have that is better for them.
Well, so it sounds like that, the welfare state that we put in place quickly became kind of normal.
Yeah, that, exactly.
Because you know, it's interesting to hear these two desire forces kind of in opposition to each other. One is, you know, if you give somebody like really dense calories, they will prefer it to everything else, you know, the Snickers bars and whatever,
right.
You know, Spam, that this really easy to get, you know, pleasure trap sort of foods. And on the other hand, there's this natural tendency to move towards better health if given the opportunity. I'm wondering how those opposing forces played out in people's lives that you were working with.
Yeah. It's, as modern medicine became available and access to health information over the internet and cable became standard, they realized that, hey, you know, we got some problems here. You know, it's now also part of the culture to have most of your relatives over 40 seriously ill with chronic disease. You know, and anybody without too much research can see, hey, this is a huge problem, and it didn't used to be that way. And I had an opportunity to actually teach a wellness class at the University of Guam, and I remember I had and I wrote about this in my book Goodbye Diabetes, where this young man who was in his early 20s was seeking to finish a college degree, and he was taking the class because it was required to finish his degree. And so I actually did what was called the Pepsi Jelly Bean Challenge screening test for all the students in every class I taught, where I would actually tell them to bring the next day to class, bring 300 calories of their favorite drink and food. And it was, in this case, it had to be a carbohydrate-based. So, you know, whatever their favorite candy bars or cookies or even if it was just white rice or whatever. You know, it's 300 calories of carbohydrates and juice or soda, whatever they normally ate. And we would check their blood sugars an hour later. And a large percentage, over a third of the young people in that college class had abnormally high blood sugars. And one of them came, this gentleman came up to me and he said, you know, I'm really concerned because after I listened to your lecture, I realized that, you know, my blood sugar is 357. And that was, you know, 1 hour after eating what he normally ate.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I had no idea. You know, I have no idea that I had any problem with diabetes. It's something that my uncle had an amputation due to diabetes. My father had a heart attack due to diabetes, and another aunt had a stroke due to diabetes. But, you know, I always thought that was something that happened when people were older. I had no idea that I already had the seeds of this germinating, not just seeds of it, but the expression of it, a full expression of it in the system. And so I ended up ordering a full set of labs for him, and he was full blown diabetic, of course. And in the course of that 10-week class, He stopped smoking. He was smoking two packs of cigarettes a day. He stopped smoking, stopped drinking beer, changed his diet, focusing on whole foods, and exercised every day. And in less than 10 weeks, he had reversed his diabetes. And you know, there's so many people like him who've never had the opportunity because they never got tested. They never become aware of how serious their health problem was right now.
Has the sort of economy and ecology of Guam shifted to accommodate people's newfound consumer desires for whole plant foods? You know, is everything still shipped in, or is there local?
The good news is that it is definitely shifting. There's many people who have started farming now, and using that as their source of income, rather than just, you know, expecting to get that government job where all they got to do is check in and check out every day. So there's definitely many individuals that are getting involved in agriculture. And it's really wonderful to see that. There's restaurants, starting up all over Guam now that are whole foods, vegetarian restaurants, vegan restaurants, many people are going to them. I was recently in Guam in December, for a week where I was speaking at the hospital and speaking to the Diabetes Association and to various groups around the island. And I was really impressed that since I've been gone now for 6 years, that new restaurants had popped up that were promoting a vegan lifestyle, and really good too. I just really enjoyed being there and enjoyed the food. So I'm very optimistic. I think in the islands, in many of the islands now, people who are looking for healthy food, people who are looking for answers, can find them.
Mm-hmm. So what are some other, aside from the obvious changes in, you know, biometric numbers and weight and health, what else changes when people shift from a highly processed, high animal foods diet to a whole food plant-based diet? You know, in the island, are there other things that happen to them, different outlooks, different ways of being that sort of naturally accompany the shift in their fuel?
You know, it's interesting. I have a great passion for the true functional lifestyle medicine or holistic approaches to living, and I've always been fascinated by the interrelationships between the choices that we make in one area and how they influence other areas. For instance, the British Medical Journal, a few years back, published a very intriguing study of young violent offenders who had been incarcerated because they were really impulsive and violent. And the study was a double-blinded, placebo-controlled study where they gave these young men who were very violent that were in prison, they gave them the experimental group got a pill that was basically vitamins, minerals, and omega-3s. That's it. And after 9 months, they decoded this double-blinded study, and they discovered that the group who was getting the actual vitamins, minerals, and omega-3s had a 35% decrease in their violent activities. And they found that this was more powerful than any other program that had been done to help people deal with their aggression, their anger, and their violence. And so So the implications are great. There's many other studies that support this concept that when somebody goes to a whole plant-based diet, it changes them not just physically, but emotionally and spiritually as well. It gives them a whole new way of perceiving the world around them, with more compassion, with more insight, and an ability to reason from cause to effect and to understand where people are coming from and not immediately, impulsively make a judgment that they easily get offended by. So I definitely saw that happen. I had one patient in particular who was actually a homeless man who had been a professor. He was a linguist, but he was so upset and so mad that he became homeless. He just checked out of life. He wanted to change, but he couldn't change. So he came, we invited him to join our program, and he just, amazingly just did everything that we suggested. He changed his diet. He stopped eating refined foods. He stopped eating meats. He was focused on whole foods only, and it basically, he transformed from being a homeless outcast to having his own radio show in the local language. It was just fascinating to watch. And it was because of his willingness to change what he was taking in. And I believe that changing your diet is a critical part of changing every aspect of your being.
Yeah, I was talking to my wife about this and kind of trying to exploring my own hunch that the diet is kind of one of, if not the crucial leverage point for people in just sort of changing their relationship with everything to become happier, to become more productive, to become a better steward of the planet. And I was trying to sort of figure out why I thought that. And she said, well, imagine someone who runs away from home and comes back for three meals a day. There's something about, when I hear you describe post-war Guam as a place that had just been utterly destroyed. There's no arable land, terrible suffering, and everything has to be imported. I kind of think about like the American suburbs where I've grown up and spent most of my life, and not to compare them in a sort of abject suffering and destruction sense, but in terms of we've destroyed our farmlands, our local family farms, we've destroyed our topsoil, and everything is being grown in feedlots, in giant monoculture. That we want to be sort of expressive individuals, but you can't be if our diet represents something else.
That's right. Absolutely right.
So I'm kind of seeing in Guam a very clear parable for where America, is going, unless we turn around our relationship to food.
Absolutely. So when we make it easy for people to eat unhealthily, when we subsidize the very foods and systems that spend millions of dollars figuring out how to make chemicals taste, smell, and look like healthy food, we know that our political system and our way of life and our future health as a society is in great trouble. Right. So we need to find ways to appeal to common sense and to really the ethics of food and food distribution. so that we are no longer subsidizing these very approaches that are destroying the health and the mind, the physical and mental health of our children and adults.
Right. So you continue to do work in Guam, but you also have a clinic in California?
That's right. I have what's called the Youngberg Lifestyle Medicine Clinic in Temecula, California, which is just about an hour north of San Diego, right in what's called wine country. So avocado groves and vineyards in this area. And so, I actually do also a lot of work by phone or Skype. I actually have patients all over the world that I work with, and I have contracts with national labs where no matter where somebody lives, I can order the labs for them, and they can go to their nearest town or city where there's a lab and get all the tests necessary so that we can see the big picture. Again, I'm a strong proponent of testing because it is through testing that we become aware of where we're at. And I'm even right now very excited about this new whole paradigm of personalized medicine where you can actually get your genome tested with a saliva sample and from that understand your unique risk factors and my job is to help people see how through appropriate dietary changes and lifestyle changes, they can actually bypass many of these genetic mutations. I did these tests myself, and I have many mutations. We all do, but most of us don't think of it that way. We're kind of naive, and we think that these diseases are just happenstance, and we don't understand why. Why did this happen to me? I was trying to live healthfully. But things happen for reasons, and a lot of them have to do with our unique genetic predispositions to disease. So by understanding what those unique predispositions are at the genetic level, not just the biomarker level, like a cholesterol or a blood sugar, but an actual genetic test, we can actually begin to turn off those genes or to bypass those genes nutritionally by applying the right strategies now.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like it's extremely motivating to people to get these tests. And I found that the testing that I've done, it's largely the positive effect has been to sort of wake me up, slap me around, and motivate me, as opposed to give me sort of a specific bit of information that will allow for a prescriptive dietary intervention. Is that what you find as well?
Right. Oh, absolutely. It's knowledge is power, and awareness is empowering, and so. Some people have this notion that, well, I don't want to know about this because then it's just going to be more and more medications I have to take and et cetera. Or I don't want to know if I have risk for Alzheimer's because it'll just stress me out and make the problem worse. But the reality though is by understanding your risk, you can actually dramatically change, neutralize, or in some way, mitigate that risk substantially. And, I tell you what my initial motivation of all this was, Howard, is that when I was 10 years old, my mother was diagnosed with a terminal brain cancer. And it's one of those events that just rocks your world. It just changes your life forever. Hmm. And I remember the night right before her surgery where she was she was calling for my brother and I to come see her. And so we went into her hospital room, and she had been crying. She'd been told she was terminal. They were going to do surgery, but it was just temporary. But she put on a great big smile for us because she wanted to be there for us, but she knew she wouldn't be there for us very long. And so I remember going through that experience thinking, how could this happen to my mother? So she, you know, she died, within 9 months, even though she'd only been given 4 to 6 weeks to live. But, it made me think. I remember saying to my dad as a 13-year-old, I said, Dad, I wish I knew right now what my risks are so I could start working on it right now. And without realizing it, that statement that was made while we were just raking leaves one autumn afternoon in the Midwest, that statement became the rallying cry, became my passion. And that's why I went into the field of nutrition and lifestyle medicine, is because I recognized that that's the only way we're going to really solve this problem with disease. You can't solve the problem with disease by coming up with a new medication. You have to treat the cause. You have to address what all the antecedents that have come together to activate this gene, or to take advantage of the gene mutations that we have that lead to disease. And so my last 25 years after my training have been dedicated to not only taking advantage of every new scientific opportunity for myself, but to share that with my patients so that we can apply that to their personalized needs and opportunities. So that's where I get my motivation, is because of what happened to my mother.
Wow. And it's, you know, it sounds like from like the medical conversation that we have in America by and large is you get something, it's a matter of fate or luck or genetics or something, and then all we can do is palliative or ameliorative. We can give you drugs, we can give you surgery, we can make you feel better. And so given that assumption, it's no wonder that nobody wants to know, right? Why on earth would I want to know if there's nothing I can do about it? That's
right. Exactly.
You know, if you give me a test and it's likely to show me something that you can't fix, that's like malpractice. That's like the worst thing you could do. And so I'm really curious, like what in your 13-year-old brain argued with that very deeply rooted cultural narrative that disease just happens and is nothing we can do about, you know, we can't reverse it. We can't say goodbye diabetes, goodbye cancer. You know, that your book title is in a sense, an affront to the American medical system that would, you know, you're not allowed to say goodbye or cure.
Right.
So where did you come up with this idea that it was that, you know, before even looking, before finding the scientific data, that disease doesn't have to manifest, it doesn't have to be a life sentence, that you could ameliorate your risk?
Yeah, that's a great question, Howard. I know that my father in particular was always interested in health, and he has four older brothers and sisters who are medical doctors. And, you know, I have about 15 aunts, uncles, and cousins, and their spouses who are medical doctors. And so, you know, there was always conversations about health. And I just, in my own mind, I just had this innate, I think, understanding that, you know, if you do the right thing, you can be healthy. And so, but that was, you know, that was just a feeling. That was something that was kind of inborn. And so I wanted to experience that scientifically in my training. And it was actually early in my training, Howard, in 1985, I attended a seminar by Dr. James Anderson, who is a renowned endocrinologist, diabetes specialist at the University of Kentucky at Lexington. And, you know, he published hundreds and hundreds of studies on diabetes in the medical literature. And his presentation blew me away because back in 1985, he was talking about research projects he had personally done in the 70s that had helped been reversing diabetes. And this is in patients who are in the hospital laying in a bed all day long, and all they did was change their diet to a high fiber, high, you know, whole food starch based diet. And that's all they did. They didn't do anything else. And they were just from 90% removal of insulin, 90% the discontinuation of diabetic medications, 70% discontinuation of insulin. I mean, and so that was the first vindication I had had in terms of exposure to science, that was congruent with what I felt I already knew before. I just hadn't seen the science. And so I knew back in 1985, that, you know, this is 12 years after my initial, you know, watershed, moment with my father. This is going to have a powerful impact, and we have the data, and so. But every year, the consensus statements are, well, there's really no cure. There's you're going to have this for the rest of your life. All we can do is kind of manage it, and then people go, oh, really? You know, there's no cure, so you know. Forget it. You know, I'm not going to put any effort into trying to treat something that I can't get rid of. Right. And so the whole system creates hopelessness in patients. And so my whole, passion is to help people recognize that there's great hope. The first step is to recognize that there's a problem, right? You recognize that this is serious. Like Norman Cousins used to say, don't deny the diagnosis, defy the verdict.
Mm.
So my job as a lifestyle medicine expert and nutritionist is to help them really understand, hey, this is a real problem. You can't keep your head in the sand forever. This has been going on a long time. You know, the average diabetic has had this problem for 15 years before diagnosis. Okay, and they've had this insulin resistance, which is the main, one of the main drivers of cancer, the main driver of heart disease, a main driver of hypertension, strokes, and autoimmune disease, on and on and on and on. And they've had that for decades prior to diagnosis. And so our job is to catch this so early that we can completely resolve the problem, and do it in a way that optimizes health for as long as possible. So that's what excites me, is helping, giving people awareness, which, you know, shakes them up initially, but then say, hey, you know what? This is completely reversible if you're willing to put the time into this. And I'm here to help you accomplish that. And so they become motivated, and joyful because they realize, hey, you know, I've given an opportunity here to dramatically improve my health and completely reverse a situation that I previously thought was, you know, unreversible.
Mm. Well, I love the word joyful. To me, that's the thing that keeps people away from making these changes. They think, you know, well, if I can't eat my favorite foods, if I can't go out and party, if I can't smoke, if I can't drink, if I can't sit on the couch and watch TV, like, my life would be joyless. And, you know,
of course, down deep, people know that that's not true. They're just kind of they've fallen into this trap, this spell that they can't, this quagmire that they can't get out of. And the first steps are changing the fuel that you put into your body, developing a plan that is cognizant of what the body needs. You know, the body needs proper rest, proper hydration, and the proper nutrients and so forth. It needs to be exposed to love and forgiveness and joy. And all of that comes together. Each one of those supports the other ones.
Right. So if someone is listening to this and they want to work with you, you work on Skype, you work remotely, where should they go to have
this
conversation?
My clinic's website is dryoungberg.com. That's dryoungberg.com. And they can get, all access to all our information. They can watch videos of things that we've done. And they can purchase the Goodbye Diabetes book right there on that website. And also make an appointment to see me either in person or by phone or by Skype. Distance is not an impediment here. Everything that I do with somebody who lives in my community, I can do the same thing for people that live anywhere in the world. And I even have online courses that I'm teaching as well.
Great. So I'm hoping that that some folks will hear this and realize, first of all that even if they're not diagnosed yet, if they're pre something, to wake up to the problem, and number two, that there is every reason to believe that making joyful, empowering changes give them complete control over the expression of their genes and their health outcomes.
Absolutely. And many of us are very naive, as I was when I was a young man, and even though I was always interested in health, and we don't realize that only the minority of our adult population do not have at least prediabetes. In other words, as an adult, if you do not have prediabetes, you're in a minority. Right now, if you're over 40, at least one out of two individuals have prediabetes or worse, and that's from 40 to age 59. If you're 60 to 74, two out of three have at least prediabetes. And if you're over the age of 75, three out of four have at least prediabetes. And prediabetes is essentially that metabolic syndrome that dramatically impacts cancer risk, heart disease risk, stroke risk, hypertension risk, and autoimmunity risk, dementia risk, depression risk. It goes on and on and on. And so that's why everybody needs to be tested appropriately with the information interpreted from the perspective of addressing the cause, not treating the symptoms.
Right. Well, Dr. Wes Youngberg, thank you so much for taking the time to share your worldwide experiences from 14 years on Guam and an incredible telescopic lens a microscopic lens into the relationship between diet and disease, to your own story about your mother and your realization of what was possible and what you were meant to do, and for all the work you do to help people live healthier, happier, more empowered, and more joyful lives. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you so much, Howard, for having me, and I wish you great success in your work as well.
Many thanks. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize. All the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.